This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This episode is also brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Father's Day is coming, and they really have everything that your dad really wants. From hand-selected gifts you won't find anywhere else, to small batch bourbons and unique craft beers. Find them in the Fred Meyer Shopping Center. Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of The Canby Current. I'm your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. The good news first. The Riverside fire is now partially contained for the first time since it broke out on September 8th. Well, the bad news? Estimated containment is at only 3%, and growth is still possible in backcountry areas. But even 3% is a large number in light of the size of this fire, Incident Commander Alan Sinclair reported at a Clackamas County press conference Wednesday. There is a lot of fire on the landscape. This is going to be a long-duration incident. Our focus is to get the communities protected so we can get people back to their homes. The Riverside fire has burned nearly 136,000 acres in Clackamas County and was human-caused, forestry officials report. Meanwhile, the Dowdy Fire, located near Estacada, is 1,452 acres and 30% contained. The fire has not moved or grown in size for a couple of days. Crews continue to patrol and put out hotspots. The Wilhoit Fire near Malala is at 591 acres and is 100% lined and 50% mopped up. The Unger Fire near Colton is at 496 acres and is also 100% lined. Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis says the inversion will remain in place with hazardous air quality through Thursday. Winds are to pick up today out of the west that will start moving the inversion air. Moisture is expected tomorrow and through the next 5 days. The mist and moisture that remains in the forecast throughout this week are expected to move further into the region, allowing firefighters to increase containment on both the Riverside and the even larger Beachy Creek Fire in Marion County. Evacuation orders were lifted for Canby, Oregon City, and other areas west of Highway 213 early Wednesday afternoon. Other evacuation areas around the Riverside conflagration were downgraded, including parts of Malala being rolled back to Level 1, Get Ready. Canby's Paramedics Division Chief Matt Dale was dispatched Monday to lead a local task force against the Bertane conflagration in Lake County. All other firefighters and assets, including those serving in Riverside, have returned home with no injuries. Air quality, however, remains extremely unhealthy and high on the hazardous index throughout Clackamas County. Air quality levels in the Portland metro area and Willamette Valley are at record lows, and Department of Environmental Quality Advisory remains in effect through at least Thursday. Davis advises residents to stay inside as much as possible and wear an N95 mask if you have to go out. Fire danger in the entire region is extreme, with no burning whatsoever allowed. Even with the lifting of the evacuation orders in new areas, residents are urged to avoid any recreational or outdoor burning, avoid any open flames, that's grills, lanterns, torches, etc., avoid any gas, electric, or battery-powered yard equipment that may get hot or create sparks, and avoid smoking outdoors. For the latest, stay tuned to our website, canbyfirst.com. Canby's first choice in news. quick content warning for our listeners. This upcoming story has a quote containing strong language. A captain with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, who provided commissioners a report about anti-fascist operatives engaged in criminal activity, was relying on a source that is determined to be false, Sheriff Craig Roberts announced this week. Roberts said, quote, "I want to clarify for the record that one of our captains indicated a source stated that Antifa was involved in possible criminal activity. That source has since been determined to be false. I also want to make sure that the public is aware that we have an incredible team of detectives that are literally assessing every single call that comes into our office in the evacuated area." The sheriff also reiterated that his office has, quote, "no suspects that have been associated with any extremist or political groups." The sheriff did, however, describe incidents of armed and unofficial citizens groups illegally stopping drivers at gunpoint to ask questions and demand identification. "They actually have been armed and are stopping individuals within the commune out there," Roberts said. "First of all, I'd ask them to do is to please stop that. We have reached out to a number of them. If they see somebody suspicious, call us. Let us handle it. It is illegal to stop somebody at gunpoint." Many of the people returning to the evacuated zones are the residents themselves, Roberts said, going to their own homes to retrieve another load of their personal belongings. "The last thing I want to see is something tragic happen because somebody is overreacting to something they believe is criminal, and it's not." A number of signs have been posted in the rural areas of Clackamas County around Malala, Estacada, Colton, and even Canby, threatening trespassers and would-be criminals with gunfire. "Home and armed. You loot, we shoot," one sign said. Another threatens, "We won't call your family. Your body will never be found. Bang, bang." In Captain Jeff Smith's comments, which came during an emergency county meeting last Thursday to discuss implementing a curfew, he told the board county commissioners that his office has reliable sightings and reports of Antifa affiliates in the Estacada area. "Equally concerning is there are reports of people from other extremist groups. It's not confirmed Antifa, but it's suspected Antifa," Smith said. "Reports and sightings of people armed with chainsaws, and the goal was to fell telephone poles in hopes of starting further fires." He also said authorities were receiving reports that people were hiding full gas cans all over the county to later ignite. His comments came 2 days before a deputy was placed on leave for being video recorded making similar comments about alleged Antifa arsonists. In the video, the deputy claimed no firsthand experience with such agents, but instead repeated reports he'd received from conservatives who were patrolling their areas of the county. "These Antifa motherfuckers are out causing hell," the deputy, who is only partially seen, can be heard saying near the end of the video. "And there's a lot of lives at stake, and there's a lot of people's property at stake because these guys have some vendetta." The sheriff's words are unlikely to fully tamp down the rumors of politically motivated arsonists, which have persisted for days despite numerous denials by various law enforcement agencies across the state, some of whom have gone so far as to beg residents to stop spreading false or unfounded rumors. Where there's smoke, there's fire. And where there's a record unprecedented and historic amount of fire, well, you get the idea. Oregon is experiencing record poor air quality from wildfire smoke across the state, according to an analysis by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and Lane Regional Air Protection Agency. Oregon air reached unhealthy or hazardous levels across the state last week on the Air Quality Index, the AQI, which categorizes how clean the air is and lists associated health risks. Dense smoke is expected to remain throughout most of Oregon until at least Thursday, and an air quality advisory from DEQ is expected to be in effect until at least then. According to a comparison of recent and historical AQI data for Portland, Eugene, Bend, Bedford, and Klamath Falls, all five cities exceeded previous daily records for poor air quality even during previous wildfire seasons. Smoke can irritate the eyes and lungs and worsen some medical conditions. Young children, adults over 65, pregnant women, and people with heart disease, asthma, or other respiratory conditions are most at risk. DEQ's color-coded air quality index provides the current air quality conditions and ranks air quality as follows. Green is good, Yellow is moderate. Orange is unhealthy for sensitive groups such as children, seniors, pregnant women, and those with respiratory conditions. Red is unhealthy for everyone. Purple is very unhealthy for everyone. And maroon is hazardous. Smoke levels are fluctuating between unhealthy, that's red, and hazardous, maroon, for Oregon and Southwest Washington. Listeners are advised to protect yourselves by avoiding outdoor activities and staying inside if possible. Keep your windows and doors closed and use HEPA air filters if you can find them. It's also possible to make your own. For details, visit this story on canbefirst.com. The Aurora Fire District, like Canby and most other districts in the area, has been overwhelmed by the generosity of its community this week, who have showered them with food, snacks, water, and other supplies to show their appreciation for their hard work throughout the Clackamas and Marion County wildfire crisis. Aurora, though, also made a pretty big donation of its own this week, offering something the average citizen was not likely to have lying around. As devastating as the Riverside Fire in Clackamas County has been, which has burned across more than 200 square miles and threatened Mallala, Estacada, and many rural communities, it has certainly been met and perhaps even surpassed by the ferocity of the Beechey Creek Fire in neighboring Marion County. As of this week, the Beechey Creek Fire has burned 186,000 acres, destroying countless houses, ravaged the remote communities of Detroit, Edahana, Gates, Lyons, and others, killed at least four people, and forever changed the Santiam Canyon. One victim has been the Edahana Detroit Rural Fire Protection District itself, a mostly volunteer agency serving both communities and a long stretch of Highway 22, which lost both its district office and a fire engine as Beechey Creek ravaged the Santiam Canyon this week. While dealing with their own wildfire crisis, Aurora Fire Chief Joshua Williams and the Aurora Rural Fire Protection District donated one of its engines to the Detroit District Friday, which was immediately put into service. The engine was signed by Aurora Fire District personnel and presented to Edahana Detroit Fire Chief Will Ewing, who was overcome with emotion and almost beyond words. The truck came fully loaded with hoses, nozzles, medical and rescue equipment, and even food and water for firefighting crews in Detroit and Edahana. Our firefighters were overjoyed to receive this very gracious gift, many of us succumbing to tears of gratitude. Edahana Detroit said on Facebook, "Thank you, Aurora Fire District. This gift is truly a wonderful, uplifting event in these very exhausting and trying times." The tiny community of Detroit has been utterly devastated by the destructive tentacles of the Beechey Creek Fire, Edahana Detroit Lieutenant Laura Harris told residents in a Facebook update Sunday. "We have approximately 20 to 25 structures still standing, and the rest are gone," she said in the somber post. One of the many buildings destroyed was City Hall, which was also where the main fire station was based. "Our primary focus is protecting the structures that are still standing," she continued. "Several of our firefighters have also lost their homes. They are working through their own losses while also fighting to protect homes still intact." One can only imagine the hesitancy employees of the Canby-based Wilson Construction might have felt in approaching their boss to ask if they could, one, be exempted from work to fight fires in the rural communities in which they live, and two, bring with them hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of the company's equipment. Actually, longtime Wilson fleet operator Scott Carr and his comrades had initially asked for the use of just one truck, but Don Wilson, president of the electrical utility contractor and son of the company's founder, Matt O. Wilson, he wasn't having it. Don said, "Take the guys, take the equipment, take whatever you need," recounted Tony Helbling, logistics manager for Wilson. "Go wherever you need to go and do what you need to do." It was pretty cool. Honestly, I think they were a little surprised, but that's just the kind of guy that Don is. About 10 Wilson employees have been aiding the firefighting efforts for several days now, working to contain the sprawling Riverside Fire and other blazes that have ripped through rural Clackamas County. Most of them are normally assigned to the company's Woodburn Mechanic Shop. Most of them live in the Mallala area. They are trained in wildland fire suppression techniques, if not necessarily experienced. When we go out and build power lines, especially in places like California, we have to have the ability to do fire suppression on site, Helbling explained. We don't normally have to do it, but we need to be able to do it. And they were certainly well equipped for the job. Thanks to Don Wilson and Wilson Construction, the crews brought with them a 4,000-gallon 6x6 all-wheel drive water truck, three F450 4x4s with 500-gallon pumps, and a 4x4 Gator with a 100-gallon pump, and a 500-gallon water buffalo trailer. They also brought lots of backpack water carriers, axes, and shovels because, as it turned out, much of the work had been quite manual. They've been doing some work on the fire lines with the trucks and the hoses, Helbling said. But yesterday, they were doing mop-up work, walking through the areas the fire had burned and finding the hot spots where it could rekindle. You have to dig those up and put them out to make sure it's fully contained. The Wilson crews have spent several days in the Scotts Mills area, said Chuck McClaherty, who worked for a different company but knows Carr from the Canby Rod and Gun Club. He jumped at the chance to pitch in for the weekend when Carr asked for volunteers. Wilson Construction Company has some amazing guys and amazing equipment they brought out to the fires, McClaherty said. There are lots of hot spots flaring up, so we just worked with the sides of the roads and helped them put it out. On Tuesday, they were dispatched to the fire line several miles east of Malala. There are, obviously, hundreds of others in the area fighting the same fires, from trained, experienced, and professional firefighters with federal, state, and out-of-state and local agencies, to civilian volunteers or construction employees doing pretty much the same thing that Wilson is doing. It may sound a little bit chaotic, but it's not, Helbling said. We're a very small part of a very big team, Helbling said. There's no adversarial relationship between the full-time firefighters, the loggers, the excavators, the Forest Service, the contractors. I think when it comes down to it is that there's just not enough people to fight the fires. Everybody is stretched so thin. And it works because they all have the same goal in mind, according to McClaherty. It was amazing to see so many volunteers helping and donating equipment and manpower, he said. I saw lots of construction companies, excavation companies, farmers, loggers, neighbors, co-workers, all pitching in, all helping however they could. Though they've been doing the work for several days, Helbling said the Wilson crews see a clear distinction between themselves and the dedicated first responders who have chosen this life for their profession. It's one thing to be a full-time firefighter, he said. It's another thing to protect your home and community, and that's what we're doing.
Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows,
no.
You know?
No. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
All right, joining us on the Canby Conversation today is Captain Brandon Paxton with the Clackamas Fire District. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, Tyler. How are you? Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you. I just want to say, first of all, from all of our grateful communities, thank you so much to you and your brethren for everything that you've been doing for us for the past week and a half, man.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this has been one of those historic events affected all our towns, our communities, neighbors, and you know, we're all sort of grateful to sort of be in a position to help out where we can, and this has really touched home. This is an event that's occurring in our backyard, and it has directly impacted a number of our firefighters who have experienced evacuations and stressful times in terms of coordinating their families. So we truly can appreciate the stress that this puts on all of the folks who have been impacted by these. So our hearts are with the community, and we feel it on an incredibly deep
Yeah, absolutely. How have firefighters in general been dealing with that? I mean, I can't imagine, like, just as a regular citizen, you know, trying to keep up with the evacuations and everything that's been, you know, impacting all of us. But then to, on top of that, be doing this incredibly critical, incredibly stressful job. How have you guys been making it through this past week and a half?
Yeah, so, again, these are those unprecedented times. And I think, you know, at baseline, our families are used to stress and used to chaos. So they probably have a little bit of a leg up in terms of being able to be adaptable. But this is something we've never seen. And our support system that we have out there has been absolutely incredible, whether that's, you know, spouses, friends, partners, families, whatever. They have been overwhelmingly supportive. Of course, early on when the firefight was really intense and changing very dynamically during the wind event and we were working through evacuations, stressful times for our firefighters just to know that their families were safe. And I think that's one of those pieces early on you want to check off your list of things to do, and that's get your family in a safe location. And, you know, when you're out firefighting, you don't necessarily have that time. So I have spoken with a couple firefighters who mentioned the stress of that, you know, and
sure,
putting that decision solely on their family to make, with just intermittent text conversations or brief phone calls within those first 48 to 72 hours where things were just so dynamic and so rapidly changing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brandon, can you give us the latest situation, whatever you think? I mean, obviously, we could probably talk all day about everything that you know about the current situation facing Clackamas County, but maybe a few of the highlights for folks that, you know, kind of the most critical information that folks need to know, and because obviously the situation just keeps changing every single day.
It does, and so I think the biggest take-home right now that we could share is that things appear to be settling down, right? So we've got good fire line development, and we're working towards that full containment. And so when I say fire line, we have crews that have built out line, and we're working to get that down to bare earth. And what we do is we work from the fire line back in towards the black. And so a lot of these fires are now circled or lined out, I guess in firefighter speak, and developing that line 50 feet into the black zone or the burn zone all the way around. And the goal is to have that built out 250 feet inside. So this is a long process. And, you know, as you drive by some of these fires, you're still going to see smoke in the area. You might still see small amounts of fire. But the lining process, that process of putting bare dirt between burned and unburned, is well underway. Our crews are working to continue to patrol for hotspots and put those out, and again, building out that structural protection zone around homes. And so crews have been working hard since day one. They haven't left and are continuing to work really, really hard building out those different lines.
Yeah.
As we move towards, you know, containment and building a line around there and de-escalating this is that time where we're putting people back in their homes and lifting evacuation zones. Clackamas County, their website, clackamas.us, is the best place to go for that, for people to get the most up-to-date evacuation zone information. And that's changing as well. And that's based off a collective effort between fire officials and law enforcement to make the best and most informed decision based off predicted weather conditions, which also throws itself at predicted fire conditions and how we feel about the number of resources in place and the line of protection that's been built. So there's a number of considerations that go into lowering an evacuation level, because the last thing we want to do is put people back into a situation that could be potentially harmful. And then, you know, another consideration that people often overlook is we want to make sure infrastructure is at least in place and not a hazard. And that's one of those things that could take longer as we move through this if there's those areas that are really heavily impacted.
Yeah. And I know that another consideration is to not have to avoid a situation in which folks might have to re-evacuate, because obviously, having gone through it myself, it is such a stressful process to do once. And I imagine it would be much harder to convince most folks to do it again. You know, like the first time it was like, yeah, absolutely, you know, we hit that level and we booked it. You know, the second time it might be I might be, are you sure? Are you absolutely, you know, it might be a little bit harder, and you definitely don't want to have that situation put people in that kind of danger. Yeah.
You're absolutely right, and that's why it really does take a collective effort to figure out, you know, what the stats are telling our fire and law enforcement officials about evacuation, because we know that. We don't want to put, obviously, people back into their situation that could be harmful. With that said, it's also important to know that these are dynamic times, and things could change, and if the order does come out that you need to evacuate, then we're asking people to really take that seriously and, and heed that advice. With that said, if you find yourself in a level one or two, and you know, if we get some improved air quality, now is a good time to consider building out a defensible space around your home.
Yeah.
And we've seen success stories out there where the fire was able to burn around a home. And when I say defensible space, it's really limbing up those trees, moving debris, you know, grass and light flashy fuels that act as ladders. So you take flashy fuel or ladder fuel with like grass to a shrub to a taller, smaller tree to a big tall tree. That creates that ladder effect. And if you can limit that and create some green space, you know, or non-combustible materials such as rock walkways around your properties, that really does provide for some increased protection.
Yeah.
And it could quite possibly save your home if the fire occurs again this year or in the future. So
yeah,
defensible space is a real thing, and you know, we hope to share more information about that and really drive that home, because this is one of those events that highlights that.
Right. And we did have that big wind event, as you mentioned, and as we all remember, that kind of kicked this off last week. So folks that are maybe just returning to their homes, there may be some debris or some fallen limbs, some things to definitely clear up when you have a chance. Yeah. Well, one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because it was interesting to me, I heard the word contained, and people talk a lot about containment, the whole concept of lining, which you've discussed quite a bit so far at length, which I appreciate. When I first heard it, I thought they were kind of the same thing. And my understanding is that containment is more the confidence that firefighters have that the line will hold. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and so early on, as we described and mentioned earlier, it's really about that lining out process and developing the line further and further into the black, so for our crews to feel confident that it's going to stay where it should. You know, and ultimately, what's going to help this is a big rain event or a snow event to fully put these things out.
Yeah.
One of the big hazards that we've seen on scenes is the idea of these root balls that sort of burn down into the ground, creating sort of a hollow atmosphere. And we've had, you know, as one of our watch-out situations for our firefighters, especially with low visibility, is walking into one of those.
Yeah.
They're very deep-seated. They smolder for a long time, so it really will take significant amount of rain and or a snow event.
Yeah. And that goes to the mop-up work that you described as well, when you're trying to create these lines, like you've said, you know, 250 feet deep. Can you describe a little bit of what that work is? I mean, you guys are out there with shovels and axes and all. It's very manual work to dig up these hot spots and put them out, right?
It is. And so it's a combination of digging down to bare mineral dirt is the goal. It's very laborious and pretty tedious to make sure that these are out, but it's really critical, especially if, you know, if we have forecast weather that maybe dries back out. I'm not saying that's the circumstance, you know, for this event, but if that were the case, we don't want to see something reignite and have another event pop up. So it's backbreaking work that our crews are out there doing, and really focused on making sure they feel confident about where that's at.
Yeah. So, Brandon, you've talked a little bit about the historic and unprecedented nature of this event. I'm sure all of us who lived through it believe that 100%. Can you, as a much more expert person in how fires work and how large events like this start than most of us are, can you describe some of the factors that created, that sort of combined that perfect storm to create what we've all just experienced?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, as we know, we had a wonderful stretch of weather leading up to this in terms of temperatures and sun. But we are, you know, we had moved into the tail end of summer, and the fuels, so the branches and the grass and the bushes, all that stuff had time to dry. And so it was a dry season. We had, you know, the moisture content of the fuels. And then what was most significant was this unprecedented east wind event. And that sort of combined with the temperatures and the low relative humidity out there and the moisture content of the fuels really just kind of created a perfect storm. And you ended up with, multiple fires breaking out, not only within Clackamas County and the region, but across the state. And you were having fires joined together, creating bigger fires that had more energy and could travel faster. And then when you have the wind, it really created the event that we just experienced. And at Clackamas Fire, and early on, we were seeing, in Oregon City, we had structure fires that were, rapidly spread into multiple acre events, and we had car fires that, on any given day normally wouldn't spread as easily, spreading through light flashy fuels and burning 10 acres and two structures.
Yeah.
It was just unreal, and our firefighters were moving from fire to fire for 48 hours without sleep.
Yeah.
So it was truly remarkable.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen it all, like you've kind of just laid out as far as the causes, some caused by trees falling on power lines, campfires, I believe, have been some of these fires have been traced to. Some of them were like in Beachy Creek, my understanding, were smoldering for weeks until the wind and other factors kind of combined to create this out of control historic conflagration. We've really seen it all.
Yeah, it's across the map, and across the state, we're looking at massive devastation as a result of all these fires.
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you a couple more questions. I know a lot of people have, and as I mentioned to start this interview, so many are so appreciative of the work that our firefighters are doing in different counties and all across our area. I guess I just want to ask you, how are you guys holding up?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I mentioned it earlier that this is an event that occurred in your backyard, and so you're working on behalf of your friends and families and neighbors, but you end up connecting with the community as a whole. And,
yeah.
I can't tell you how important it is for our firefighters to feel that, and when they're out there on the line and people are honking their horns and waving and saying hi and thank you, I mean, it really just means the world to our crews.
Mm.
And that's honestly what keeps you going during those times. Because early on, when resources were light, they were working really, really long hours.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, moving from call to call. It was moving from call to call and working really, really hard and then moving on to the next. So the outpouring of support is incredible. But really, we need to focus now on those who have been impacted by this and make sure that the resources are in place for that. And Clackamas County has done a fantastic job providing those resources. Again, their website is Clackamas.us, and it covers everything from mental health to the resources people would need as they move into the recovery phase if they were impacted by a loss of a structure. So some really great resources, but really it is that time for us to collectively come together as a community and buoy those people up and make sure they've got the resources and the help they need. Our firefighters have dealt with this, but really I think we'd ask that the focus remains on those who are impacted. So with that said, I think there are two great ways for people to get involved to donate in terms of resources, and that's financial, if it's an option. Of course, the American Red Cross is a staple in the community and has the resources in place to accept those donations and support those who have been impacted. And then the Clackamas Emergency Services is a local managed by a board out of Clackamas County that typically was put to, it was first started to put money in the hands of first responders to help those community members who were in need. But they've since branched out to help those who have been impacted by tragedy. And certainly this is one of those times, and they're a great resource as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, thank you is not enough. Don't have the words to express how deep our gratitude is to our firefighters. But you mentioned it, but the long hours, the incredibly physical work, the emotional toll of fighting to save your own communities, and in some cases, even probably folks that firefighters may know, some of their properties, or maybe might even be near their own properties at times. The mental strain of this unprecedented event and trying to figure out where the fire is going to go next and how to stop it. I just can't imagine everything that you guys have been through. I just thank you for doing it.
Yeah, of course. And as I mentioned earlier, it's it's devastating to see all this, but, you know, I think our firefighters are honored and humbled to be a part of this and to serve in this way. And again, let's hope it doesn't ever happen again, but, you know, we can, I think, all rest assured that we'll be here in the event it does.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We trust that for sure. My last question, Brandon, more recent updates that we've been getting from the county and from the Riverside Incident Management Team has really been kind of lengthening out our view of this crisis. We've been talking more in positive terms, and things are definitely improving. Definitely looking forward to and hoping that rain stays in the forecast here later in the week like it has been so far. But all indications are that fully, you know, putting out this Riverside, this huge Riverside fire, is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. I've heard that quote.
Yeah, in connecting with our federal partners and the incident commander out there, it really is. It's a very large incident, and it will take a long time for this to actually be fully extinguished. And that's something we anticipate, and we'll take things as they come and make sure people are fully informed and updated as to how the progress is going.
All right. All right. Well, thank you so much again, Captain Paxton, for taking time out to talk to us. I know you're about to run into another meeting. I really appreciate you taking time out and updating us and more than that, for everything that you and, again, your brethren have been doing this past week and a half for us.
Yeah, it really is our pleasure. And, you know, as we move into the recovery phase, certainly I'd love to, again, take the time to further explain and answer any more questions you have. So please feel free to let me know.
Will do. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime. I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me. Three generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? We have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Police beat for the week of August 11th through August 17th. At 7:27 p.m. on August 11th, report of a hit and run damage to, it's already starting. Can we just have 1 week without a parked vehicle getting defaced or beaten down? Haven't we done enough to our parked vehicles? I guess not. At 7:27, report of a hit and run damage to a parked vehicle. Based on witness information, an officer located the at-fault driver, who advised they were unaware that they had hit the parked car. Well, I guess that's okay that they didn't know. And insurance information was exchanged. Well, good for them. At 6:33 p.m., an uninsured vehicle was being driven by a suspended driver and impound. The driver was also cited for having an open container of alcohol, which is always just the best thing you can have while suspended and uninsured. On August 12th at 9:30 p.m., an uninsured vehicle was being driven by a suspended driver and was impounded. And looking down the list, it looks like August 12th was the day of suspended driving, I guess, because at 10:20 p.m., a speeding uninsured vehicle was being driven by a suspended driver and was towed away, so that's good. At 11 p.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by a suspended driver was stopped. More on this story, heroin, methamphetamine, and a stolen license plate, as well as various pieces of identification not belonging to the driver, were seized prior to the vehicle being impounded. So, you know, just a real class act. Guys, if you got a daughter, that's the one you want them with. Oh, that makes me sad. On August 13th at 4:30 a.m., response to a report of a vehicle crashing into a tree. Were they drunk or on heroin? No, the tree fell into the road, so it's not their fault, guys. At 10:30 a.m., report of windows at a business being broken into overnight. So that's fun. At 11:10 a.m., report of a theft of building materials. So if you see any devious buildings going up, you know that the stolen material went there. On August 14th at 4:20 p.m., report of a hit-and-run damage to a parked vehicle. At 11:06 p.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by a suspended driver was impounded, and the driver and the passenger were given a courtesy ride home. That's nice. On August 15th at 12:22 a.m., response to a report of assault, and one arrest was made. At 6:29 p.m., report of a criminal mischief after the window of a work van was broken. On August 16th at 2:30 a.m., the owner of an RV stopped in a parking lot, was contacted, and then arrested on an outstanding Cook County warrant. You can't outrun the warrants, people. Especially in an RV, they're too slow. 5:36 p.m., a known transient was cited for reckless burning after he ignited a pile of trash under a bridge, which we all are a little sensitive to right now, but back in August, wasn't as big a deal. I mean, it was still a big deal. I'm not diminishing the crime. You know what? I'm going to move on. At 10:53 p.m., response to a report of hit-and-run damage, and you guessed it, to a parked vehicle. Officers located the suspect vehicle nearby and then arrested the driver for DUI, alcohol, reckless driving, and hit and run vehicle property, and for being not original in any way. On August 17th at 8:13 a.m., response to a report of hit and run damage to a street sign, because they must have missed the parked vehicle and just run into the other smaller thing that wasn't moving. And then at 10:51 a.m., they just went back and vandalized a parked vehicle. So that's cool. And finally, at 8:47 p.m., a driver was arrested for DUI, controlled substance. Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hair and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.